At this time, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to turn over the session to Louis Krauss, who is our moderator for today's session. And Louis, the microphone is yours.
Thank you very much, Robin. Welcome, everyone. I'm Louis Krauss from the Pacific ADA Center, moderator for today's ADA audio session. And we're looking at institutional and community living through data, an ADA Participatory Action Research Consortium report. On June 22, 1999, the United States Supreme Court held in Olmstead v. LC that unjustified segregation of persons with disabilities constitutes discrimination and violation of Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA. The court held that public entities must provide community-based services to persons with disabilities when such services are appropriate, the affected persons do not oppose community-based treatment, community-based services can be reasonably accommodated, taking into account the resources available to the public entity and the needs of others who are receiving disability services from the entity. So today's webinar will examine what the data says has happened nearly 18 years after that decision. The Americans with Disabilities Act Participatory Action Research Consortium, or ADA PARC, a federally funded research project examining participation disparities experienced by people with disabilities post-ADA and Olmstead, has assembled some nationally recognized speakers today to present the issue in a few ways. I want to acknowledge the funding of the ADA PARC from the National Institute on Disability Rehabilitation, National Institute on Disability Independent Living and Rehabilitation Research. And these are the players of the ADA PARC, most of the regional ADA centers that provide training and technical assistance, and the ADA National Network, and some our research partners there at the bottom, TIR Memorial Hermann, University of Illinois Chicago, Syracuse University, the Center on Disability at the Public Health Institute, and the University of Northern Colorado. And also an acknowledgement of a list of individuals who have worked on the ADA PARC project and are acknowledged here. And I will spare you reading every one of them, but you can look at them as you would like. So let me give you some background about the ADA PARC. The purpose of the ADA PARC was, as noted there on the slides, to collaboratively examine the participation disparities experienced by people with disabilities post-ADA and Olmstead, and we wanted to identify and examine key environmental factors that contribute to these disparities. We also wanted to benchmark the participation disparities and highlight promising practices at the state and city levels. And finally, to action plans and strategies for dissemination and utilization of the findings to be used by ADA centers and others in the community in capacity building and systems change and initiatives therein. We initially established a series of cities in the first 7 ADA center regions for which we would develop the data, and this is a listing of all those cities on the right-hand side and the states that they are representing. The ADA PARC took an initial step to collect this existing data that we assessed were indicators of the three main areas of participation disparity and presented it on our website at adapark.org. The data are presented there as maps and tables, and we're going to concentrate today on community living, which is the first one there, which looks at issues around community versus institutional living, HCBS spending, and money follows the person transitions. There are also areas of participation disparity areas that we looked at in terms of community participation and work and economic participation. Today's discussion is going to focus on community living aspect of the ADA PARC data. And before we get to our main speakers, let me describe what's available on adapark.org for community living. On this slide is the first page of the Community Living Indicators page of the ADA PARC.org. I realize this is an image and may not be visible to everyone, so let me quickly read it through and so you get a sense of what Community Living Indicators cover page says. It says, a basic goal of people with disabilities and an underlying concept of the Americans with Disabilities Act is equality and the freedom to choose to live independently in the community. One demonstration of this was the 1999 Supreme Court ruling in the Olmstead case, which found that institutionalization of individuals who are able and want to receive care at home and in the community constitutes discrimination under the Americans with Disabilities Act. In this section of the ADA Park website, we provide indicators that can be useful in determining whether people with disabilities are living in the community. The Community Living section includes measures on where people live with disabilities live in the community, and there's three indicators there: percentage of people with disabilities living in an institution, percentage of people with disabilities living at home, and percentage of people with disabilities living in other group quarters. And also programs and spending for community living. And these are have four indicators: the ratio of home and community-based services, HCBS, participants to total long-term support services, or LTSS, the ratio of HCBS expenditures to total LTSS, the number of persons on Medicaid 1915C HCBS waiver waitlist, and the number of money follows the person transitions and conception. So as a prelude to going to our speakers who will talk about the last four, let me talk about the first four of those, the first three of those indicators. We can understand whether people with disabilities are living at home or in their community by looking at data on whether such people live in institutions or not. This is important because Medicaid, the health care program for people who are poor and have a disability, ordinarily pays for persons who meet certain disability criteria to live in an institution such as a nursing home, but not necessarily to live at home. To find out the percentage of persons with disabilities living in an institution by state, we use the American Community Survey, which is an ongoing statistical survey conducted by the U.S. Census Bureau that samples a small percentage of the population annually. This measure allows us to know which states are doing well and helping to keep people with disabilities out of institutions and at home and in the community. So looking at the map, average state percentages from 2010 to 2014 of people with disabilities living in institutions ranged from 3.1% for Arizona and Nevada to 9.2% in North Dakota. Many western and southern states have lower percentages of people with disability living in institutions. Statewide comparisons here are useful because states with lower percentages may have policies in place that help more persons with disabilities stay at home and in the community and out of institutions compared to other states. Now if we look at the second indicator, looking at the percentage of people with disabilities living in the home or community, the state percentages from the ACS averaged over the 5-year range of 2010 to 2014, ranged from a high of 96% in Nevada to a low of 87.2% in South Dakota. These figures contrast with the previous map, living in an institution, with western and southeastern states such as Arizona, Nevada, New Mexico, South Carolina, and Alabama having a high percentage of their citizens with disabilities living at home, and with central northern states such as North Dakota, South Dakota, and Minnesota having some of the lowest percentages. Finally, we can look at percentage of people with disabilities living in other group quarters. Other than living in an institution such as a nursing home or at home, individuals with disabilities may also live in residential facilities such as assisted living centers and other group homes. These living arrangements are classified by the U.S. Census Bureau as other group quarters, and they make up a significant percentage of disabled living arrangements in the nation. From 2010 to 2014, the average percent of people with disabilities living in group quarters range from a high of 5.8% in the District of Columbia to a low of 0.7% in Arkansas. The ADA Park is also developing benchmarks, as I described earlier, and we'll be coming to the website soon, but this is an example of what our benchmarks will be looking like coming to the in community living indicators. So you can see that some of the best states have a summary score across the indicators, and those tend to be in the West, Alaska, Oregon, Arizona, Hawaii, Nevada, or some of the worst states, Kansas, Connecticut, Iowa, North Dakota, and Utah, are quite low. ADA Park is also conducting individual community living perspective through some interviews. We've done this primary data collection with 104 interviews of people who have transitioned out of nursing homes and institutions to the community via the Homestead Initiative. And we've been comparing participation levels, the needs and issues in nursing home versus community, and rating the levels of participation in the community using the Kessler National Organization of Disability and Harris questions, and also qualitatively describing transition and trajectory over time. So that is what the ADA Park has been doing. If you have any questions about the ADA Park or the community living data on our website, here is my contact information there at lewisk@adapacific.org. And before I now turn it over to our speakers, I want to remind you that if you do have questions, as the speakers are going through the presentations, please go ahead and enter them into the chat window, and we will read them off and answer them together verbally at the end. Our first speaker today will be Charlene Harrington. Dr. Harrington has been a professor of sociology and nursing at the University of California, San Francisco since 1980. She was elected to the American Academy of Nursing and the Institute of Medicine, now the Academies of Medicine. Her research has included designing and managing a model California long-term care consumer information system website, studying state Medicaid home and community-based service programs and policies from 1994 to the present, and directing the National Center on Personal Assistance Services for 10 years, as well as assisting with a new community living policy center. She has testified before the U.S. Congress on long-term care research and policy, written many articles and books on nursing homes and long-term care, and lectured widely in the U.S. and internationally. Dr. Harrington will review the online survey certification and reporting data called OSCAR and its replacement, the Certification and Survey Provider Enhanced Reporting, or CASPER system. These are administrative databases of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that support the survey and certification function of institutions. And she will also review the CMS Nursing Home Compare 5-star rating system and its available quality information on deficiencies, staffing, and quality measures. Charlene, I will turn it over to you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Lewis. I'm going to be reporting on trends in nursing facilities, staffing, residents, and deficiencies in the U.S.
I'm sorry. I need to stop you, Carol, because we're getting feedback from your computer, I think. Are your speakers off on your computer?
Yes.
Okay. Lewis, are you hearing that feedback?
I am not.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. This is a report that's going to be released very soon by the Kaiser Family Foundation. But I will also be including some other data on nursing home information. The number of nursing home residents has gradually declined over the past 20 years. And the number of beds have declined. And this decline has continued since 2009. Even though the percentage of the population aged 65 and older has grown substantially. As the demand for nursing facility care has declined, the occupancy rates have also steadily declined from 84% in 2009 to only 82% in 2015. The nursing home occupancy rates vary widely across states, with the lowest percentages shown on the map in the white colors, and that's occupancy rates less than 75% in Texas, Oklahoma, Missouri, Arkansas, Louisiana, and also some parts of the Northwest, including Oregon, Idaho, Montana. So these states appear to have an excess supply of nursing home beds. One of the main changes that has occurred in the past decade is the increase in Medicare admissions to nursing homes for short-term rehabilitation care and the expenditures by Medicare have also increased. That Medicare is for individuals that are aged and disabled. The states with the darkest color have 2.5 admissions for every bed, while the states with the light color have 1.2 to 1.5 admissions per bed. So this shows that Medicare residents frequently go into nursing homes, but they do not stay for a long time period, usually about 30 days. The next slide shows the distribution of nursing facility residents by primary payer. In 2015, 62% of residents were paid for by Medicaid for low-income people, 14% by Medicare, and 24% by private insurance and out-of-pocket payers. So even though Medicare is paying for more people to go into nursing homes, the overall percentage at any given point in time has remained about the same. This figure shows the share of nursing facility residents paid for by Medicaid. States with the darkest blue color had more than 70% of total residents paid for by Medicaid. These states are Louisiana, Mississippi, Georgia, and West Virginia. If federal Medicaid funds to states were to be cut by the federal government, the greatest financial impact would be on states with the highest percentage of Medicaid nursing home residents. Now turning to the issue of what type of residents are in nursing facilities. Some residents are admitted with low care needs. In 2010, states with the darkest color had 19% or more residents with low care needs who could perhaps live at home or in less restrictive settings if they had adequate long-term care support services. This includes Wyoming, Illinois, Missouri, Oklahoma, Louisiana, and Connecticut. A growing proportion of nursing home residents are under age 65. States with the darkest color had 19% or more residents under age 65 living in nursing homes in 2015, who could perhaps be living at home or in less restrictive settings. These states include California, Nevada, Utah, Arizona, Missouri, Illinois, and Louisiana. The percentage of persons with developmental disabilities living in nursing facilities has declined from 2.7% in 2010 to 2.2% in 2015, as states have developed more appropriate services in other settings or at home. At the same time, individuals with psychological diagnoses or mental health needs have increased from 24% in 2010 to almost 32% in 2015. The concern is whether these individuals are receiving appropriate services and whether they could live in less restrictive settings if they had long-term care services and supports. Now, looking at the types of nursing facilities, these have changed over time. This slide shows the percent of for-profit nursing facilities has declined steadily from 26% to 24% in 2015, while the for-profit ownership has increased. The percentage of for-profit nursing facilities vary widely by state. Seven states shown in the dark blue had 80% for-profit nursing facilities compared to states that spent less than 50%, that had less than 50% for-profit ownership. Nursing facilities chains have grown since 2009. And currently, chains own or operate 56% of all nursing facilities in the U.S. in 2015. The 16 states with the darkest blue color had 65% or more facilities owned by chains. 12 states in the white color had less than 50% owned by chains. One of the strongest predictors of nursing home quality is the nursing hours that are provided to residents. This figure shows that the total nursing hours, which is the dark bar, has increased from 3.9 hours per resident day in 2009 to 4.1 in 2015. The RN hours have increased from a 0.7 hours per resident per day up to a 0.8. So there's been a steady increase in nursing hours, which is a very good thing. Although the hours have increased, almost half of nursing homes have very low staffing, and 25% have dangerously low staffing in 2015. States with white or light blue colors had lower than recommended average staffing levels, and that included New Mexico, Georgia, South Dakota, and Illinois, whereas states in the darkest blue color had higher staffing hours per resident per day. We know that staffing hours vary by ownership group, and this figure shows the differences across different types of owners. Only nonprofit and government nursing homes have close to the level of staffing recommended by experts, which at a minimum is 4.1 hours per resident per day and 0.75 RN hours. For-profit chains and non-chains had significantly lower staffing, and they also have more deficiencies on average, which is not shown in this figure, but we know from other research. So this figure is from 2003 to 2009, but the most recent data show the same pattern. Now, turning to deficiencies, which are a measure of quality of care, nursing facilities in the states with the darkest blue color have the highest average number of deficiencies. These are violations of federal regulations that are issued by states on annual inspections and complaint investigations. The states with the dark blue color, which are mostly in the west and western part of the United States, appear to do the better job of enforcing standards than states that have the light blue or white colors. These states are primarily in the south and the upper northwest. Although deficiencies, having fewer deficiencies could indicate better quality, there's no evidence that these states have better quality of care. In 2015, the most common nursing home deficiencies were issued for failure to meet nursing standards for infection control. Almost 50% failed to do that. The other frequent deficiencies are failure to prevent accidents, poor food sanitation, and 36% of nursing facilities received deficiencies for inadequate quality of care, and almost 29% for giving unnecessary drugs. So in summary, we see the trends that nursing home occupancy has steadily declined, even though the population 65 and over has increased, while Medicare short-term rehabilitation use has steadily increased. Medicaid continues to be the major payer for nursing facility residents. Some residents in nursing homes have very light care needs, are under age 65, and have special needs for mental health services. The for-profit and chain ownership has increased, and the research shows that these types of nursing homes have lower staffing and poorer quality in general. Nurse staffing levels, which are so important, have improved, but they are still very low in about half of the nursing homes in many states. Overall, the quality of care continues to be a problem throughout the state, and enforcement varies widely across states. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, Charlene. That was great. And Charlene has done an incredible job of laying the foundation here in this talk about understanding nursing homes and situations in nursing homes and institutions and the issues that arise. Our next speaker will be Steve Eichen, our research manager for Truth and Health Analytics, now part of IBM Watson Health. Mr. Eichen has managed data analysis, program implementation, and system improvements projects for state and federal agencies since 1999 with a focus on home and community-based services. He's the lead author of the annual Medicaid Long-Term Services and Supports Data Reports. Mr. Eichen has written dozens of reports describing promising practices to improve long-term services and supports with topics including comprehensive systems reforms, rebalancing, money follows the person, and services for people with autism spectrum disorders. Medicaid long-term supports, services and supports have undergone a profound transformation over three decades from an almost exclusive emphasis on institutional services to the current reality in which home and community-based services, or HCBS, are a majority of long-term supports and services expenditures. States continue to improve their long-term supports and services systems to reflect individuals' preference for community living. He will examine the evolution of Medicaid LTSS and present the latest available data on Medicaid LTSS expenditures and beneficiaries. Steve, over to you.
Great. Thanks, Lewis. And, appreciate you mentioning that we've changed our name. Excuse me. We've been purchased by IBM, and we're part of the IBM Watson Health business now. Those of you who have known our work for a long time, you've heard us under names from MedStat, Thomson Reuters, Thomson Healthcare, and Truven, and now we're in a transition. We're still using the Truven Health name, but we're also part of the IBM Watson Health business. And you know, there's some exciting opportunities to work with the rest of the company. So as Lewis said, and he did a great job of explaining this in his introduction to the whole webinar, you know, historically Medicaid had an institutional bias, and it still does have an institutional bias, as Lewis said, where institutional services in nursing homes, in state centers, state hospitals for people with mental illness, especially for older adults and children, those are entitlement services. Nursing homes are a mandatory service of Medicaid. The home and community-based alternatives are typically optional services. Home health is the exception, but it's often used in a post-acute manner. So home services or small group settings are optional services in most cases, and in many cases not an entitlement. Now the bias has decreased over the years as practical matter, and we can see that in this graphing, in this chart that trends data for more than 30 years. I want to thank the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services for funding this series of reports. We've, between my boss Brian Burwell and myself, we've done these reports for more than 25 years. CMS has supported them for more than a decade. So we have a strong sense of trend data for expenditures. We have 3 years of data on beneficiaries now, so we're building a trend line with beneficiaries as well. So we can see progress over time, and I'll share with you some of that progress and some of the trends over time as we proceed. The balance between institutional and home and community-based services has shifted significantly since 1981, from less than 10% of spending in the early 80s. Nowadays, HCBS is 53% of expenditures, and that's 2014 data, is the latest data we've published. I also want to thank Audra Winslow, who was the lead author of the report that summarized the 34 years of data we have at this point. And really appreciate her help in making this data accessible and meaningful. Now, I want to just preface all of these expenditures are both federal and state. Medicaid being a federal and state partnership, we count total expenditures, which includes the federal share and state share. So the federal commitment will vary by state based on you know, what the federal percentage is for that state. So if we look at the next slide, the evolution toward HCBS, if you look backwards, it looks like a slope, generally steady progress toward increasing HCBS, getting services more to the home and community-based options that the vast majority of people prefer. But if you look at this slide, you can see it's not something that necessarily just happens organically. It's the result of policy and legislative changes that have supported this expansion and enabled it to continue. I won't go through the full list, but you can see the Olmstead versus LC Supreme Court decision that Lewis mentioned in the introduction, the Americans with Disabilities Act itself in 1990, the establishment of Section 1915C waivers in and of themselves, even the Affordable Care Act and the Deficit Reduction Act legislation passed during administrations with both parties have had an impact on this larger trend. If we look at the next slide, this slide shows expenditures adjusted for inflation. And we can see that institutional expenditures have stabilized. The highest line is total LTSS, which tends to climb steadily upward. It's kind of flattened since 2010. I don't know if that flattening will continue. There's one state that really had a drop that I think was a one-time situation. So we might see that upward trend, again, with total LTSS. With institutional services, the line with the blue squares, you can see it trends upward until 2002, and then when controlling for inflation, institutional expenditures have actually decreased since that year. 2002 was the year of the highest number of Medicaid-funded nursing facility residents, so we think that that's a main reason for that decline after that time period. And you can see that steady rise of community-based services. And just for the data nerd note, the inflation adjustment we used was the gross domestic product deflator, an indication of inflation over the full economy. It's a pretty conservative indicator, so all these lines would have higher slopes if we used a different indicator, such as the consumer price index, which is more individual spending and didn't seem as appropriate for government-funded services. This table shows the expenditure trends in five-year periods. It's average rate of growth for, in most cases, five-year periods, and you can see the same pattern that I just described. You can also see that all since the early 90s, the trend has been toward less overall expenditures increase for both total LTSS, for HCBS, and for institutional services, which now are actually declining when you control for inflation. Since 2011, there's been a flat trend for total expenditures. But even back to the late 90s, it's been a pretty a slow growth rate. Now, a majority of HCBS are funded through Section 1915C waivers, which passed in 1981. You can see it's 51%, which is actually the lowest percentage we've seen in our years of data. And part of that has been the rise of managed care. If you see the next few items here, we see personal care at 18%, home health at 7%, and home health at 6%. I got these backwards. And then 7% is for HCBS for managed care authorities. Now, I want to make sure we're clear what that is, because the name, it's not all managed care, because managed care actually could permeate all these different types of HCBS. But it's particularly HCBS that's not authorized by these other authorities. So if you have a managed care program like Wisconsin's Family Care or Minnesota's MCHO that is part of a 1915C waiver, we include those expenditures under 1915C waivers. But if it's purely, if the state, say, removed their 1115 waivers like Vermont and Hawaii for most cases and Rhode Island have done, and Arizona is another example, those HCBS under Section 1115 demonstration waivers are counted under HCBS managed care authorities. So that's grown to 7% of the total home and community-based services, and it's growing portion of those expenditures. The next slide shows the distribution of institutional expenditures. Not surprisingly, nursing facilities are the bulk of institutional LTSS expenditures at 77%. Also, intermediate care facilities for individuals with intellectual disabilities. Mental health facilities, this is a combination of disproportionate share hospital payments for those facilities and payments for children under the age of 21 and adults age 65 and older. It's about evenly split between those two types of payments. The 1% for institutional MLTSS unspecified. That is for spending that's reported on the CMS 64. There's special reporting for managed care payments that states participating in the balancing incentive program have had to use. And it's required for all states starting in 2016, where states break out their managed care spending between acute care, institutional LTSS, and non-institutional LTSS. When we receive that data, we use it, but we don't necessarily know what type of institutional spending it is. So that's 1% of institutional LTSS, and it's also part of the HCBS managed care authorities that we see in that 7%. Now we'll move on to beneficiaries. We have less historic data, but the current data is, I think, pretty interesting. It's good to see the contrast between the expenditures and beneficiaries. The most recent beneficiary data we have so far is 2012. Two-thirds of the beneficiaries received home and community-based services. If you count people who received both, you know, this might be someone who benefited from the Money Follows the Person program, was in a facility, and then moved to the community. Could also be a person taking a different pathway, being in a waiver and having their condition worsen and being admitted to a nursing facility. If you take both of those items into account, 70% of LTSS beneficiaries received HCBS, and about one-third of beneficiaries received institutional services. The balanced percentage, the percentage is greater here because HCBS has a lower average cost than the institutional services. And if you add these numbers up, we have about 5 million people that received Medicaid LTSS over the course of the year. Really about 4.8 million, but we know we're missing some managed care data. So, you know, it's pretty fair to round up to 5 million people receiving Medicaid LTSS in a given year. A majority of these beneficiaries are under age 65. We have 45% in that 65 and older age range, almost as many in the 21 to 64 age range, 39%, and 16% of beneficiaries under age 21. Now, we also break out balances by subgroup. These categories are not very clean because people can fit within multiple categories. We're basically making some reasonable assumptions of what diagnoses tend to be associated with different program authorities. You know, for example, personal care is more commonly used among older adults and people with physical disabilities than other types of disabilities. It's not exclusive, but it's a general pattern. Similarly, rehabilitative services are more commonly used for mental health, behavioral health services. So these are approximations, but they're useful approximations. If you look at the blue line, people with developmental disabilities has had a stronger balancing statistics for expenditures since we've been able to track data, which is 1995. 75% of expenditures targeted to people with intellectual and developmental disabilities was for community services. We don't know the number, but a fair number of that amount was for what Lewis showed in the census data earlier as the other group quarters. A small group home type and small group settings are used in the 1915C waivers. So those are settings that can be used across populations, but tend to be more common among people with developmental disabilities. And I think that's part of the factor for that higher balance. If you look at older adults and people with physical disabilities, we just kind of abbreviated AD for aging disability, you can see that general upward trend going up to 41% in 2014. And then for behavioral health services, for people with serious mental illness or serious emotional disturbance, we didn't have the rehabilitative services data until 2010, so the expenditures were really, underreported. Because it was really just the mental health facility data for the most part. Once we have that data, we have a benchmark of 28% in 2010, and we've seen an upward trend to 41% in 2014. The balance not only varies by type of diagnosis, but also by age. Younger folks tend to be served in the community more than people age 65 and older. You can see folks under age 21, 12% of those folks in institutional settings, mostly residential facilities for residential treatment facilities related to mental illness, and a larger sum for home and community-based services. For adults age 21 to 64, you can see it's 18% institutional only and only 4% receiving both. It's about even for people age 65 and older. They're still more likely to receive HCBS, but it's by a small amount. You can also see the balance vary by state. You know, along with the national policies I mentioned earlier, state policies matter when it comes to the distribution of resources for institutional and community-based services. There's quite a wide range from Oregon at 79% to Mississippi at 27%. And one reason I call it Mississippi is not only that they have the lowest percentage, but that percentage is going upwards. We've heard great things about work that they've been doing to improve the balance. So I hate to just pick on them for having the lowest percentage, because they are actually making good progress. And I think in future years we'll see that percentage continue to increase. It's about an even split in terms of how many states have expenditures over or under 50%. 25 states in D.C. have 8 CBSs above 50%, 24 states below that amount. And this is all 2014 data. Now, if you look at kind of two-year progress, we highlighted 10, you know, this was an indicator for states making recent progress. If you look at 1 year of data, there tend to be little quirks in state reporting that can highlight a state. You know, state might have expenditures go up and then they go back down. So we use two-year trends to kind of smooth out those one-year quirks. So these 10 states showed the greatest percentage increase in HCBS expenditures from federal fiscal year 2012 through 2014. The first seven of these, from New Jersey, Ohio, Missouri, Iowa, Texas, New York, and Arkansas, were all participating in the balanced incentive program. And you know, most of those states started that participation during this time period. I forget which state started in 2012, but for the most part, they joined in 2012 or joined in 2013. So it's not necessarily an indicator that the balanced incentive program made that impact. It might be a correlation of states that want to improve their system also want to participate in the balancing incentive program. We'll see the full impact, I think, longer term, partly because states will have been involved in that program, also because the structural changes in the balancing incentive program provided states a financial incentive to adopt practices that have worked well in other states, such as having a no-wrong door for accessing services, a standardized assessment. Those practices should also help the states in the long term with improving access to community services. So we may well see progress for a longer period of time. Now, I have a slide for questions and discussions, but I think we'll save that for everybody. After Carol's done, and we can have questions from everybody. Here's my contact information, and the link is kind of long. I don't want everybody to scramble and write that down. If you go to Medicaid.gov and you search that site for LTSS expenditures, you'll be able to find all of the reports that lead to this data. And certainly, please let me know if you have any questions about the data. And I think we can pass it on to Carol. Lewis, I'll let you make the transition.
Great. Thank you so much, Steve. Appreciate that. And so that was a great follow-up. So we have the understanding of nursing homes, and now we have the clarity about Medicaid long-term supports and services and the changeover in potential balancing going on there, more heading toward home and community-based services. From what Steve showed us, so that's great. Our final speaker today is Carol Irvin from Mathematica Policy Research. Dr. Irvin's career is focused on assessing policies and programs related to healthcare access, particularly for vulnerable populations. She currently directs two national evaluations of Medicaid programs. Since 2007, she's directed the national evaluation of the Money Follows the Person demonstration, a Medicaid program that seeks to help states develop and strengthen their approaches to transitioning people from institutions to community-based care. She also directs Mathematica's evaluation of four different types of Section 1115 Medicaid demonstration programs. But today, Carol is going to present the latest findings from the National Evaluation of the Money Follows the Person demonstration. And using data from reported by the states from National Medicaid and Medicaid Administrative data, she's going to provide information on how Money Follows the Person demonstration has grown, which beneficiaries participate, and the types of outcomes associated with the demonstration. And a key focus of the evaluation has been to determine whether the Money Follows the Person demonstrations are transitioning people who would not have transitioned otherwise, and what their post-transition outcomes are like, particularly how the quality of their life changes after moving to the community. So Carol, on to you.
Thank you, Lewis. I really appreciate it. And thank you, everyone, for attending the call today. As Lewis said, I'm here to talk about the latest findings from the National Evaluation of the Money Follows the Person Rebalancing Demonstration, which is a Medicaid program that has been around since 2007. And it was actually in March of 2007 when we entered into a contract with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, to conduct this evaluation. So we just recently celebrated our 10th year anniversary studying this program. I want to start, not knowing my audience perfectly well, I wanted to start with just some basic background so everybody on the call has the basic understanding of what this program is about. As Lewis mentioned, MFP is about helping states figure out how to reduce their reliance on institutional care. It's also here to help them develop community-based long-term services and supports in preference to institutional care. And basically, this program is about giving people with disabilities more choice about where they receive services and to allow them to participate as fully as possible in the communities. This program has been popular. Most states have taken up the demonstration. The map that I'm showing you right now just shows that not only which states are participating in the demonstration, but also which cohort. Most states got their first grant awards in 2007, but we have had some grant awards that occurred in 2011 and 2012, and states like Montana, South Dakota, and Alabama are the states that are the youngest, were the ones that started their programs most recently. So MFP programs actually are have two components to them. One is the transition program. That's the one that you've kept track of this program at all. That's what you hear about most frequently. But there is also a rebalancing program, which I'll discuss in a little bit. But I always start with the transition program. And as of the end of 2015, the participating states, the 44 states, which includes the District of Columbia, have transitioned more than 63,000 people since the inception of the program. And I have seen the data for 2016 recently, and essentially what you see, what they did in 2015 is what they were able to repeat in 2016 as well. So in this, what this graph shows you, the big long upward sweeping line is the cumulative total number of transitions that have occurred. And then we have two other lines. The middle one, which is made up of little triangles, is the number of current participants, the number of people they served in each six-month increment. And then the bottom line represents the number of people they transitioned during that six-month period. So in 2015, the states transitioned a little over 11,000 individuals that year. Now, the transitions are not evenly distributed across the states. We have a number of states that are very small in terms of the number of people that they have served. South Dakota and Alabama, as of the end of 2015, were the smallest of the programs. But then we have Texas on the other end of the spectrum, a program that has transitioned now more than 10,000 people. And the volume of transitions are concentrated among seven states in particular that account for more than half of all participants. That includes California, Connecticut, Maryland, Michigan, Ohio, Texas, and Washington. Now, I'd like to put the volume of transitions into some perspective. And as part of our evaluation, we have been tracking the size or the number of people actually eligible for this program, which is about 1 million people in any given year. And so since about 2010, the demonstration states have and their transitions have represented about 1% of the people eligible for the demonstration during a year. Now, if you are someone, depending on what your perspective is, this may be a conservative estimate. And I've had arguments about this estimate with my colleagues here at Mathematica. If you are somebody who believes that there is a group of people for which institutional care may be the preferred setting, then this is definitely a conservative estimate because it includes everyone who has met the length of stay requirement for MFP. To be eligible for MFP, you have to be in institutional care for at least 90 days. And some of my colleagues would say that there is a group of people, and they usually point out people with severe dementia who may not be served as well in the community as they could be in a facility setting. Even if we take account of those individuals in our estimate, MFP is still a small program. But what our estimate represents is the belief that everybody who is in a facility could possibly live in the community with appropriate support. The other way in which I think about this volume is I look at it in relationship to the amount of funding that was set aside for this program. When Congress set up the program, they initially allowed it $2 billion for MFP transitions. And then when the Affordable Care Act was passed, they doubled that to $4 billion. So the $4 billion, though, is to be allocated over a minimum of 10 years in that they started allocating funding in 2007. The last allocations were given out in 2016. States actually have until 2020 to spend their entire allotment. So that's actually the $4 billion now is getting spread over 14 years. And remember, is actually in the end for 44 states and the District of Columbia. So when you think about the amount of money into HCBS services, which is something that Steve was just talking about, this ends up being a fairly small amount of money actually put aside for so when you look at it in that regards, then the number of people they transition is actually pretty impressive. Now, over the years, I've been asked, you know, Carol, what are the ingredients of a successful MFP transition program? And at various points during our 10-year studies program, we've gone out to talk to program administrators to find out what they think, from their perspective, makes for a strong transition program. And some of the common themes that we've heard over the years is, one, you've got to have strong referral networks, which require strong partnerships with the state agencies that serve the targeted populations. Outreach has to happen on an ongoing basis. You can't just do it once, put some information out there into the world, and expect people to remember and come to you for assistance. You've got to keep conducting outreach all the time. You also have to maintain good working relationships with the facilities, and this can be tough sometimes because when a transition program approaches a facility, they can feel fairly threatened that they're going to lose their residents. In our research, we have also found that having strong partnership with housing agencies is key as well to these transition programs. If you're on Medicaid, you have low income. And if you enter institutional care, it doesn't take very long for you to be in that facility before you lose your housing, can't keep up with rent payments. And so many of the individuals who end up long-term in facilities tend to have lost their connection to any kind of housing in the community, and they need help reestablishing that. We have also heard and seen that strong partnerships with providers of support services. Those are the providers that will be serving individuals once they're out in the community. It's also very important to a strong transition program. Most states and most MFP programs, though, have continued to struggle with an insufficient supply of affordable, accessible housing. I think that is a chronic and going to be an ongoing issue for every state. States are also noting that, you know, they could transition more people if they had more community-based providers and more direct service workers. And then also, many of the states learn just how challenging it is to serve people in facilities who also have mental and behavioral health conditions as well. A lot of times, transition coordinators don't have a lot of experience with this kind of population, and they've had to learn by doing. Last year, we did a focus study on transitions for working-age adults. So these are people under the age of 65, because MFP seems to be doing a particularly strong job with this population. And when we were first talking with grantees about this, a lot of them scratched their head and said, well, you know, we don't understand why we're doing better with younger adults, because very few of our procedures, processes are age-based. But as we talked with them, they did note things like younger adults tend to have stronger networks of peers and informal supports. You know, we heard many times someone who would be able to transition out and say, you know, I've got other friends who, you know, they're not elderly. They would like to get out too, and now I'm going to help them get out. They also tend to be very highly motivated to make the move. We've also noted that for this population, there seems to be particularly strong transition coordination services for them, and flexible community-based services has also been important for this population. And then in a couple of states that we talked with, they said, you know, we've been working really hard at integrating mental health services with other community-based providers, and as we've done a better job with this integration, we think we've been able to do a better job helping adults under the age of 65, particularly those with behavioral health conditions. So as Lewis hinted, one of the key questions that we have been researching for the Money Follows the Person program is whether or not the transitions that have occurred have actually increased the rate of transitions from facilities into community-based services. You know, when we look at the data, we saw people transitioning from a facility into HCBS before MFP ever began. And so the question is with MFP, can states transition more people? And over the years as we've studied this, one thing we've learned is that the results are very sensitive to which states are in our analysis. And how many years we're able to include. And it's also sensitive to the methods that we use. So that, in fact, right now we say it's we can't answer this question conclusively one way or the other, and that any finding that we've been able to produce so far we don't think is very robust. However, one thing we have been seeing in the data is that MFP participants don't seem to be like the other people who transition. And they don't seem to be much like the people who are eligible for permanent or non-eligible. What I mean here is when we compare to the full eligible population, tend to have a lower care needs. Many times they have a lower incidence of dementia and even mental health issues. When we compare them to other people who transition to community services, they just do it outside of the MFP program for whatever reason, we know things like they are, MFP participants have had longer stays in facilities than the other transitioners. They also are less likely to have used HCBS services before they went into institutional care. And the other interesting thing that we have seen, but we can't necessarily explain very well, is that MFP participants are far less likely to use hospice services compared to other transitioners. So we think that they are less likely to be near the end of life than the other transitioners are that we've been comparing them to. And so all of this is I bring up because there is information there in the data that would suggest that MFP participants are different than other people who are transitioning, and in fact these programs may be transitioning people who would not have transitioned without MFP. We have looked at post-transition outcomes such as the likelihood people are going to remain in the community long term, whether or not they return to institutional care, or mortality once they move to the community. And here, again, our conclusions are not very solid or robust, many for the same reasons as why our transition rate analysis have not been considered very robust. Other questions that we've looked at is what happens to healthcare costs when people make the transition and what happens to their quality of life. This has been a very robust result in that, and this won't be surprising to people on this phone, is that when people transition to the community, their healthcare costs, both their Medicare and Medicaid costs, decline, primarily because their institutional care costs have dropped as well. Quality of life results have also been extremely strong in that the quality of life of MFP participants increases after they transition and then remains, and there's very little fall off into their second year of community living, which is what this graph is trying to present here. The area where we see the biggest jump in the quality of life is people's satisfaction with their living arrangements. Before they transition, about 60% of participants are saying, I'm pretty happy with my living situation as I have it. But after they've been out in the community for a year, that percentage saying that they're happy with their living situation has shot up to 92%. And in the second year, it drops down to about 91%, but still very high. In this next slide, these are two other domains of quality of life that we've been looking at. Only here, decline, a shorter bar, means an improvement. The first one is about people's unmet need for personal care. Before they transitioned, about 16% told us that they had experienced an unmet need for personal care. And 1 year after the transition, that percentage has declined to about 6%. And 2 years after, it's down to about 5%. And then in this last set of bar graphs, we're looking at the barriers to participating in the community. Before people transition, about 49% were telling us that they've experienced some kind of barrier to participating in community life. After they've transitioned that first year, about 33% say they're still experiencing some kind of barrier. And then 2 years later, 28% are saying that they're still experiencing some barriers to community life. So better, but more could be done. I want to talk a little bit about the rebalancing program. As I mentioned at the beginning of my talk, states need to implement two components. A transition component as well as a rebalancing component. When states transition people to community services, those community services that they provide during the first year of living in the community, the states receive an enhanced match from the federal government, and that enhanced funding they are supposed to plow back into community-based services. And that money is what we call their rebalancing funds, and what they do with it, that money is what we call their rebalancing program. So in this slide is showing the growth in the amount of expenditures the states have made from their rebalancing funds. We get this information at quite a bit of a lag, so that our last data point here is from December of 2014. where states were reporting about 230 million dollars in spending from the rebalancing funds, and that was quite a bit a large increase from what they had reported for 2013. We're going to expect to see 2015 at an even higher rate. So the acceleration and the spending of these particular funds happen later on in the program. What do they spend the rebalancing funds on? 16 states spend most of their funds on increasing the 1915C waiver capacity in their state, providing more slots for more people to participate in waivers. But they will also use this money to add waiver services. 11 states are using the rebalancing funds to provide housing supports. A lot of this funding is going to support housing specialists. 11 states are also reporting they're using their funds for transition services. Sometimes this is transitioning other people outside of the MFP program. So in conclusion, I want to look a little bit toward the future, because as things stand right now, MFP, the last funds, as I noted, were given out last September. And the program is set to come to a formal end in 2018. That will be the last time states can transition people. And then they have until 2020 to expend all of their grant funds. However, I have been in conversation with Senate staff who are indicating that they are trying to pass legislation to extend the demonstration for another 5 years. I don't know if they're going to be successful in this climate, but we'll wait and see what happens. So in looking toward the future and how do these states sustain their the gains that they've made under MFP, well, they're going to have to find ways to keep up outreach and referrals for transitions. They need to be finding ways to finance their transition coordinators. They've been doing that with grant funds. They're going to have to find ways, if they are committed to doing this, to institutionalize transition coordinator positions or rely on community partners to do the transition more so than what they have before. They're going to need to find ways to keep up their interagency partnerships, particularly with housing, and finding ways to keep housing specialists in their roles. I think other ways in which states can continue to foster a philosophy of assisting transitions to community living is through payment policies and quality performance measures. You know, I've seen through some of my other work that there is a some momentum across some states to put into place value-based purchasing programs for nursing home care. It's going to be interesting to see where that all goes and whether or not those kinds of initiatives can promote shorter stays in nursing facilities and getting people out more quickly into the community. And then I think all states are going to have to continue to work on strengthening their direct service workforce and supports for family and informal caregivers. And then in my last slide here, I talk a little bit about, you know, there is some Medicaid policy going on that may or may not promote community care over institutional care. I think some of what's happening with the accountable care organizations may influence what's happening on the Medicare side. I know a lot more about what's happening on the Medicaid side and the growth of health homes. PACE is still a program out there that's viable, and parts of CMS are looking at ways to expand that program. Medicaid accountable care organizations are being developed, and I've mentioned payment policies as well. So with that, I'd like to conclude. Here's my contact information. Information about our work is available both on the CMS MFP website as well as Mathematica's website. So with that, Louis, I'd like to turn it back to you.
Great. Thank you so much, Carol. All right, everyone. So this is a good time for you to, if you have not written in a question, to go ahead and write your questions into the chat room, and we will get to those. We'll take them in order of when you send them in. And while you are working on those questions, I wanted to, first of all, Carol stole the question right out of my mouth, which was, what does the future hold? But maybe what we can do is to open that question to Charlene and then to Steve about maybe what does the future hold in terms of each of the areas that you discuss. So, Charlene, do you have a point about to make about the future, like in terms of the nursing home data?
I think we'll see a continued growth in the use of Medicare nursing home services, and we'll probably continue to see a decline in the number of nursing home beds. So many nursing homes are targeting their services toward the Medicare short-term residents and prefer to have services for them rather than long-term stay residents. So, and we do see an excess capacity in some states, so I think those states will continue to have a decline, even though the population, of course, is aging. So I think that will be the major trend.
Okay, and Steve, you have any thoughts on the future for HCBS and LTSS?
Yeah, you know, one thing that Carol hinted at in terms of value-based purchasing, you know, that's definitely further along in the facilities, in the nursing facility space, but a number of states are looking at that in terms of HCBS or just in terms of encouraging balancing in and of itself, you know, kind of prodding, using, especially in managed care environments, using the managed care contracting process and using that, you know, including contract requirements that spur the system on toward great, you know, toward serving people in the community. We're seeing that more. We're actually participating in CMS's Innovation Accelerator Program as part of the community integration through LTSS subject matter area. There's support for states in what they call incentivizing quality and outcomes, or IQO. And that's basically working with states to move toward value-based purchasing. You know, there's a lot to do, so I don't know if we have any states that are actually going to say, you know, boom, we have, you know, it's today and we have value-based purchasing. But, you know, next year, year after, I think we'll see some states. And a few pioneers are there already. The other thought I have is just generally speaking, community-based services are the norm. You know, living in home, living in small group settings, that's the norm, that's the expectation now. And the policymakers' attention is also being moved toward how to make sure that community is really worthwhile. And we see that in the CMS regulations on home and community-based settings. We see that in the experiences of care survey that CMS has developed with proven support to measure the quality of a person's care. We see it in Carol's findings in terms of the quality of life survey. It's an accomplishment to get to serve people where they want to be served, but it's also, I think there's a growing push to really make sure those services are doing well for people. And I think we're going to see more work in the quality of the community environments that people are living in as we move forward.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I also wanted to point to that as well, because the ADA Park, as I mentioned earlier, we did some interviews with individuals who are transitioning, and using that quality of life question about care, we were finding, similar to what Carol showed, that even if you're in the community, the care that you're receiving gets rated to be higher than it is in an institution where you have staff who's there all the time. So this seemed like a counterintuitive finding, but looks like Carol's showing that as well, and maybe you are as well. Anybody want to hazard some ideas about why the care might be better in the community than when you have staff sitting there in an institution with you?
You know, I saw Carol's statistics, and I thought of what Charlene said about the staffing ratios. So it may well be that there are staff in the building, but they are sufficiently busy that folks are still having gaps in care. That's just a hunch. And Charlene and Carol can better address that.
I definitely agree with that. We see that the staffing levels in so many homes are inadequate, and as the resident acuity increases in the nursing homes, there's more work to be done, but not enough staff to do it.
And I'll just chime in. One of the other components in the quality of life survey is asking some questions about how you're being treated by the people who assist you with, you know, are you being treated with respect and dignity? And the information tracks in a similar way in that they feel that once in the community, working with community-based services, that they people are treated with more respect and more dignity than when they were in the facility setting.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I'm going to ask the operator, are there any questions on the phone?
Ladies and gentlemen on the phone line, if you'd like to ask a question at this time, please press the star, then the number one key on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question over the phone line, please press the star, then the number one key on your touchtone telephone. I'm showing no questions at this time.
Okay, that's fine. That's great. Thank you. So I wanted to give, we do have one question that's coming via email. How is, for any of you to answer here, how are the data that you've shown being used by the advocacy community to affect change in their states? Let's just go in order here. Charlene, do you have any idea about that?
Well, I can speak for the nursing home advocacy groups. They are definitely using the information about quality of nursing homes in terms of their advocacy efforts, but it's an uphill battle because most emphasis has been on advocates that are in the community. I think the challenge for us is to be able to get the data that we have out to the advocacy groups so that they can use it.
Yeah, and hopefully that's going to be an opportunity there for the ADA Park data. We'll try to get as much of this data up as we can and guide people to where further data is, and hopefully that'll be an opportunity. Steve, any idea about your data?
Yeah, I've definitely seen it in action with some of the states with which I'm familiar. Some states have used it, and some advocates within that state have used it. If their state is looking particularly low, either in the balance of institutional and community spending or in the amount of spending. We also calculate the expenditures per state resident for each program authority, for total HCBS, total LTSS, and rank states on a per capita basis. So if your state is an outlier or is noticeably different from border states or whatever your state considers its peers or fair comparisons, there's an opportunity to use that data to show how your state could do things better. I've seen that in action in both directions. I've seen some states wishing they were not number one, and I've seen states, knowing that they were fourth to last and using that as a spur to action, or advocates pushing them along the way.
And Carol, your thoughts?
Yeah, over the years I've seen our data used in two primary ways. I'm also thinking that I'm probably not fully aware of all the ways in which our information has been used, but I know the transition numbers get used by the advocacy community to help argue for more transitions and, prodding state Medicaid programs to do more and better in that area. And then I know that the quality of life information gets used quite a bit. I think that has a lot of salience for people, particularly for advocates. And as a result of getting a fair number of questions about the quality of life data, in the annual report that we put out last year for calendar year 2014, that was the first time that we presented state-level information about quality of life statistics. We put it in appendix at the back without any kind of narrative for people to use. And we have a report for 2015 that's been in clearance now for quite some time that we're hoping will get out soon into the public domain, and that will have updated information in there as well. I think the other way in which I've seen it used is, this becomes anecdotal information, but we will frequently put out a report and then somebody from a Center for Independent Living will contact me and say, what you said here resonates with what we're finding in our state, and, here's some more anecdotal information that goes along with that. So I know that it's our reports are being read and people are getting something out of them.
Okay, great. And we've got a specific question for Carol that came in. Do you think that CMS will continue to provide funding for transformation grant of the type previously provided given the current administration? And what about including the new HHS administration?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I have no inside information. I don't know anything more than what's out in the public domain. I know that there's a lot of staff there who are dedicated to this area, and there'll be a lot of work around managed care and MLTSS, I know that, and trying to make those programs stronger. But I don't know about the transformation grants, what the future holds for them. Sorry.
Okay. And we have a question here for Steve. Do you have a sense of how effective Community First Choice has been in providing HCBS and the effect a rollback of this ACA-related program would have on the states? And maybe you can give a quick rundown of what that is for some people who might not know, Steve.
Oh, you bet. So Community First Choice is an optional, it's a new state plan optional service that was set up in the Affordable Care Act. And it's a multi-service benefit. I forget the precise nature of the benefits, but it includes attendant care. I think there's a requirement for states to offer participant direction. If you go to Medicaid.gov and search for Community First Choice, you'll get some good information on it. It has some unique supports for transition services. I know they can pay for the first month's rent, which no other program authority can do. So there are some unique benefits to Community First Choice. In our expenditures data, for the most part, whenever we see a state adopt Community First Choice and the spending increases there, we see a concomitant decrease in expenditures in another program authority. In California, that state used it to provide a broader benefit than their personal care program. So people were able to get a little more robust benefit, but there wasn't a significant increase in overall HCBS spending. In Oregon, there was a substitution effect for 1915C waivers. Their overall spending did go up, so I think there was some impact on their waiver waiting list as a result. Maryland, I think they came in with a new benefit. I think most states can repurpose an existing benefit. Maryland used it to expand access to services. It was more of a new benefit there. There's actually, I think it's NORC is doing an evaluation of Community First Choice, and their findings are available. Again, if you go to Medicaid.gov and search for Community First Choice, you can find that information. I think the reports to date don't cover a lot of the implementation time span, but for the few states that have adopted it, it's a pretty big chunk of expenditures because California is involved, and starting in 2015, New York is going to be involved, so it's a big number, but in terms of number of states and overall impact, it's been a relatively small impact to date. And you can get more information about that from NORC's evaluation.
All right. Well, it is the bottom of the hour, and I want to be respectful of everyone's time. So I think we'll end there. And I want to thank Charlene Harrington, Steve Eichen, Carol Irvin for your time and your presentations. It was really great. And I believe at this point, Robin, I will turn it back to you to do any wrap-up that you want to do.
Great. And thank you very much, Lewis, for your moderation of today's session and our presenters for spending their time with us today, departing this very critical, important information. You will receive an email shortly after the conclusion of this session, which will provide you some instructions related to how you can access the evaluation for today's session. We really encourage you to participate in that process, as your feedback is very valuable to us. It will also give you information about how to obtain a certificate of participation for today's session. The session was recorded, and it will be made available as an archive on our website, as I indicated earlier, during the instructional phase. The recording should be up in the next couple of days with the transcript, edited transcript, available in approximately 7 business days. The handouts from today's session were available prior to the session, but are also going to be available on the archive section of the website, again, www.ada-audio.org. Under the archive section, you'll be able to find those. That information. But again, watch for the email, which will have more details, and we really, again, appreciate your completion of the evaluation for us. We will not be having a session in May. May is a big, busy month for the ADA centers and the National Network nationally with the ADA National Symposium, which we are hosting here in Chicago this year. So we apologize that we will not be having a session for May, but please watch the schedule for future postings. We will resume again in June. So again, thank you, everyone. Now to exit the system, all you need to do is hang up the telephone and or close your browser and or use the file in the upper left-hand corner and choose exit in the drop-down menu. Again, thank you, everyone, and have a good day. This concludes our program.